And welcome to CAT Scan, the Prince George Cougars podcast. Well, on the last edition of our podcast, you heard from Ronnie Shuker, and this is going to be part two. He's author, editor, writer, and editor-at-large for the Hockey News, recently published a book about an eight-month coast-to-coast hockey road trip through all 13 provinces and territories. The book is called The Country and the Game, 30,000 Miles of Hockey Stories. Well, you went, Ronnie, coast to coast, and it all began in Newfoundland, and that's where the book begins. Sort of tell us about the experience that went on there, some interesting stories. I imagine being with Newfoundlanders, there were many to recount.
Oh, yeah. Newfoundland is a remarkable province. I understand why it was sort of its own country before it joined Canada in 1949. It's just geographically it's different. The people are different. The accent's different. The hospitality is different. It was, you know, what really stands out hockey-wise from Newfoundland is that the way hockey there was described to me is that Newfoundland is sort of one giant hometown. So, you know, in any other province in the country, you know, I'll take Ontario, for example. If you're in Toronto, and, you know, a player from Cochrane, Ontario, makes the NHL, you're probably not going to cheer for him as hard as you would a player from your hometown. Newfoundland is different. It doesn't matter where you live in Newfoundland. It doesn't matter where a player out of Newfoundland comes from. If he or she comes from Newfoundland, any Newfoundlander is going to pull for them. From the early 1990s to, I think, about 2019, the St. John's Telegram published a list called Newfoundlanders Away, and it would just chart where players had gone. They had left Newfoundland to pursue a hockey career at some level, whether it was university or junior or semi-pro or minor pro or even NHL. And people would, you know, they would email the curator. He retired in 2019, but they would email him every year and say, is the list coming out? They want to see the list. They want to know where the players were, how they were doing. And that's just the way Newfoundlanders are with hockey. They cheer for anyone who comes from the province, and they cheer hard. They support them in any way they can. And I just found that across the province. And they're wonderful storytellers. One that stands out is going to talk with the two Terry Ryans, Terry Ryan Sr. and Terry Ryan Jr., who are both former pros. They are characters in and of themselves. If anybody has watched the Spit and Chicklets podcast, they will know that the Ryans are regulars on that podcast. And I was just invited into their home with Adrian Mizzi, who was with me for that part of the trip. And I just, you know, from the minute we got in, we just sort of sat down, and Terry Ryan Sr. just sort of launched into his draft story. He was drafted into the NHL by the North Stars, I think, but he says that he was supposed to be the Leafs' number one draft pick the year he was drafted. So he just launched his draft story, and from then on, it was just story after story after story about hockey. And then his son, Terry Ryan Jr., came in about half an hour into the conversation, and we transferred to his time in the game and playing with getting drafted by the Montreal Canadiens in the mid-90s, trying to make it. He played only eight games, and he ended up, by his account, being one of the biggest first-round busts ever. And now he's sort of transformed his career into a life in the arts, where he's now an actor on the comedy series Shoresy. He's a podcaster. He's written books. He's gotten a degree in folklore. He's just this eccentric guy who was known for a really scrappy guy in his time in the minor leagues and his short stint in the NHL. And he was just regaling us with stories about fighting Darren Langdon, fighting Ty Domi three times as an 18-year-old. And he's still fighting. Before the Newfoundland Growlers folded, Terry got to play one game as an emergency call-up. The Growlers were decimated, I think, by an illness of some sort. And so they called Terry up just to play one game. He was 45 or so at the time, might have been late 40s. And he's just so loved in his home province. He got a standing ovation. He fought a guy who is 22 in the third period, left to a standing ovation. Like, it's just, it was just Newfoundland hockey at its best. So that's one story that stands out, but there's just so many stories from Newfoundland to tell. I could have written a book just on that province.
Yeah, they've got their old clock there. They're always half hour ahead.
Yeah. I don't know why. I'm still trying to figure that out, but yeah, so be it.
Now, a half hour ahead of the rest of the Maritimes. In BC, of course, they're 4.5 hours ahead, but that's sort of where the journey began, was Newfoundland, and that's where the book begins.
More or less, but I did. I did a figure eight because I left from Toronto. I went through eastern Quebec up to Labrador, and I stopped in a few places in Labrador before I hit Newfoundland. So the trip, the road trip, starts in Toronto. The book more or less starts in Labrador. I went to Labrador City, Churchill Falls, and Happy Valley Goose Bay, where I spoke with a lady by the name of Roxanne Dyson, and the president, volunteer president of the Hockey Federation there, Craig Penny. Just sat with them in the local arena, and they just talked to me about hockey in Labrador, and they told me one story of a young boy. He was 13 or 14 at the time. His name was Aiden O'Keefe, and he had battled leukemia, and he managed to get it in remission. And then just before Adrian and I arrived, his leukemia had come back. And Roxanne just sort of told me everything that the community would do to support the family. You know, she was, you know, buying orange tape that kids could put on their sticks to just support Aiden and went any way they could while he was getting treatment in St. John's and then later in Toronto. And it was just one of those stories about a small town supporting a kid going through a tough time. Unfortunately, Aiden passed just a few days after we left Happy Valley Goose Bay. But it was a remarkable story of a kid who taken too young, but fought till the end and loved the game to the end. As these kind of stories of small town hockey and hockey in small town Canada hit me all across the country in one way or another. And this one, one really stood out to me. I've gotten a few emails from people who read that story and teared up. I didn't meet Aiden, but he sounded like a remarkable kid.
Right. And then you went across the country. We will get to the Prince George part and the BC part, but as we go across the country, Quebec, and you call that What is a Canadian?
Yeah. So the first place I stopped in Quebec was Laval. It was just a pickup game. Adrian had set this up through somebody he knew, just a bunch of guys who play a pickup game at the Colisée Laval, where the semi-pro team in the LNAH, I'm not going to try and say the French name. My French has gotten worse since I did the road trip. But it's the semi-pro Quebec League, which is really known for fighting. So the pro team plays out of this arena. And they're just these guys who play Sunday night hockey together. They've been doing it for, I think, 20-something years. Adrian got us on. And in the dressing room, as soon as we got in there, we just started getting chirped by a couple of Quebecois players, which is wonderful. You know, if anybody's played hockey, they know that if you get chirped in the dressing room, it's kind of like a rite of passage. So I was grateful to get chirped. And the way he was chirping us was about King Charles getting, assuming the throne, because Queen Elizabeth had just died. He said, "What do you think about your new king?" And I was actually very confused because I know we're a constitutional monarchy, but I don't register the king or queen having any impact on Canada. So I kind of blanked for a moment, but then I realized what he was talking about. And I said, I don't think about it very much. And he said, "But you're Canadian." So we just started bantering back and forth. We went out, played the game, came back, picked up where we left off. And then we started having this fairly intense political conversation. And as you know, politics is a powder keg, even at family dinners, right? And, you know, in a hockey dressing room, you would think it'd be a powder keg. But because we had just played an hour and a half of hockey together, you know, we were sitting in our sweaty equipment in this dank old dressing room of this beaten down arena. We just had this very cordial conversation about Quebec sovereignty and, you know, what it means to be a Canadian, what it meant for them to be Québécois. Like one of the fellows, I asked him, I think Adrian asked him, does he consider himself Canadian? And he outright said, I am Québécois because of my language. I will never, ever call myself Canadian. And I think in any other situation, you might get offended. But because we shared this game, this love for this game, we just had an honest conversation about it. And, you know, it wasn't a powder keg. It was a polite conversation that I think politicians could learn from. That's how you carry a, you know, on a tense topic, that's how you carry out a proper conversation. And we just listened. They listened to us. And, you know, we agreed to disagree, but it was just, hockey did that all across the country. It would take maybe a tense subject and make it accessible for both sides. And we never did solve the question, what is Canadian, but that was my attempt at doing so for that chapter.
Now, when you go to these new places, towns, cities, what kind of level of hockey are you watching? Because it varies depending on where you are.
Yeah, I watched basically every level of hockey. So I watched the NHL. I picked up an NHL game in Calgary. I watched junior games. I watched senior hockey games in Saskatchewan. I watched minor pro in Quebec and Thetford Mines. I watched, there's a semi-pro league in the James Bay Cree community that nobody knows about. It's just, it's more like a roving circuit of tournament than a real league. There are 11 towns in the Cree Nation of James Bay, and they just, they're a different town hosts every week or every other week during the hockey season, and the teams just go there and they play for I think the prize money is $20,000-$30,000, and there are some legit semi-pro, minor pro players there. Like the talent in the James Bay Cree Nation was off the charts. I played with some of these guys just shooting pucks around. Thankfully, I didn't play a game because, boy, could some of those guys shoot the puck and skate. And I went to a kids tournament in Rankin Inlet, just an under-11 tournament, just to find out what, you know, youth hockey meant to a, you know, a remote community like Rankin Inlet. So I saw a tournament in Whitehorse, men's and women's hockey, different levels. I covered the inaugural women's division of the Yukon Native hockey tournament. I saw beer league play. I mean, every level of hockey I saw across the country, and that was really the purpose, is not to. I mean, the NHL is important, and I made that in part of my book. I followed stories about Bobby Orr and Gordie Howe and Wayne Gretzky, but there's so much more hockey in this country. You know, those aren't the only stories to tell, and I wanted to see hockey at every level, and I did.
Was there any place you went to in Canada that was not hockey-driven?
No, is the short answer. But in saying that, there is one place that struggles to be a hockey town or a hockey island, as it turns out. That's Haida Gwaii in BC. I found out that there is no ice surface in all of Haida Gwaii, which has, depending on who you talk to, somewhere between 3,500 and 5,000 people. And there's this team called the Haida Gwaii. They're just an old-timers team called the Haida Gwaii Islanders, and they play in a tournament every year in Prince Rupert. But there's no ice rink, and because Haida Gwaii is a subtropical climate, they're lucky if they get one, or if they're really lucky, they'll get 2 weeks of frozen ice a year. And sometimes they'll get none, because the weather usually is between 0 and 20 degrees. So if it doesn't get below freezing, they have no ice, so they have a roller rink, but that's it. but they love hockey. They have this underground hockey community. They play roller hockey whenever they can in this sort of dilapidated barn in a town called Masset in the northern part of the island. And every year they take a ferry across to Prince Rupert, play in just an old-timers tournament, a beer league old-timers tournament. And that's the only time of the year they get on the ice other than the few days, week, maybe 2 weeks if the weather is good one winter. But they're a hockey community like any other across the country, even though they don't have a real ice rink.
Was there any part of the country that stood out to you that was at the top end of being hockey town?
Yeah, I think every part of the country loves hockey in its own way. But I was really captured by the northern communities, especially many of the First Nations communities, simply because of their size and because they're so remote. I think hockey takes on an importance and a gravity that maybe it doesn't south of the Trans-Canada, where there are so many more distractions, so many more things to do. The winters are shorter, the summers are longer. In these communities, you know, there's a rink, and that's really the focal point of the town for the entire winter. You know, Rankin Inlet is a perfect example. When I flew there, there was just an under-11 tournament going on at the local arena, and I kid you not, at least half the town was filing through that arena in support of the players. You know, it wasn't a pro team. It wasn't a junior team. It certainly wasn't the NHL. It's just a bunch of kids having fun playing the game. And it's, you know, that's just the way it is in many of these First Nation communities. Hockey is the focal point of the winter. The way it was described to me there is that it's just part of the cycle of life. It's 8 months of hockey, 2 months of fishing, and then 2 months of grinning and bearing the bugs in summer when the black flies and other insects get really bad. But, you know, for 8 months of the year, hockey is the focus of the town. And I saw that firsthand when I went there. People just, the way it was described to me by the president of the Hockey Federation was, everyone is invested because everyone is involved. And that was very apparent in not only Rankin Inlet, but many of these First Nation communities that I went to.
Now, in your book with Ontario, you call it Hockey's Heartland.
Yeah, I was struggling for a title for Ontario. And I didn't want to ascribe Ontario any more importance than any other part of the country. 14 million people live in Ontario. The bulk of NHL players from Canada come from Ontario, just sheer numbers. Saskatchewan sends the most per capita, depending on what source. I mean, that's a bit disputed, depending on the source, but that's generally the province that sends the most per capita. But Ontario sends so many players, the population is so large, that I just wanted to find a way to give a name that represented the game that didn't. I hope nobody takes offense to it in any other part of the country, because every province, every territory is a hockey heartland in one way or another. But that's the one I chose for Ontario.
Any particular place in Ontario that stood out to you when you went there?
Well, we talked about the Bill Barocco trip. That remains a highlight.
Right.
And the Beer League Hockey Hall of Fame, the 80-plus Hockey Hall of Fame. But, you know, I went to Thunder Bay, and this was a really interesting one. I really wasn't sure what to expect when I went, because I had discovered that Thunder Bay has a giant Finnish community. And, you know, a lot of players of Finnish descent had gone from the community to the NHL. Not specifically Thunder Bay, but Chris Pronger, he's from Dryden, which is a couple hours away from Thunder Bay. His grandparents live in Thunder Bay, and he's of Finnish descent. And it's just this community of Finnish people that came after the First World War. And it's the largest Finnish diaspora outside of Finland. And they have this team called the Finn Kings. It was originally called Ripus Finlandia. It was founded in 1987 by a guy named Jussi I'm going to butcher his surname, Kuakonin. And I just went there to learn about the community, learn about how this team was founded. It was just a way for the Finnish community in Thunder Bay to sort of bond and play other Finnish communities. There are all these Finnish communities in Northern Ontario that have Finnish names. One stands out. It's called Uppsala. And like Northern Ontario is just peppered with these Finnish names. And so in the 80s and 90s and in the 2000s, the team would just travel to another Finnish community and they just play beer league tournament with other Finnish communities. They would just go to one community, have a tournament, and then, you know, the next weekend there'd be another tournament, another Finnish community. And I just learned about the history of this team, how it sort of kept the community together. It's now known as the Finn Kings, and I think there's only one player of Finnish descent left on it. So the community is slowly thinning out, but that was really interesting. I just went and they were, the fellows who had founded it were now in their 70s and 80s, and I just went and had coffee and finished food with them, talked hockey, and learned about the team they had set up.
Who is the oldest hockey player you ran into, and how old was he?
The oldest had to have been Peter Austin with the 80-plus Hockey Hall of Fame. He plays in a league, the Burlington Old Timers Hockey Club. He plays in what he calls the Gold Division, which is the lowest division in the club. So the Burlington Old Timers Hockey League, there's no solid stats to back this up, but from my research, it's the largest old timers club in Canada, possibly North America, maybe even the world. And his team, their name, they have NHL team names in I think every division, but especially the Gold Division. His team was the Maple Leafs that year. He's a Canadiens fan, unfortunately for him. But yeah, so he just invited me to play with the team and then go to their after-hours haunt called Hector's, where we just sat, had beverages, and talked about the 80-plus Hockey Hall of Fame, how he got into it, how he plays hockey into his 80s. He told me that the way to know whether a team is in the Gold Division or not is that every team has its own doctor. And there have been times where guys have had heart attacks on the ice. So I just talked to him about playing hockey in their 80s and, you know, what it entails. And he just regaled with me stories about it.
So you ran into nobody in their 90s then?
No, I did not. Although there is a fellow in Calgary. I don't know if he's still playing. His name escapes me, but I did read about it in a Calgary newspaper. He was in 96, and he didn't really pick up the game until... he was a very good junior player, and then he dropped it for about 40 years, and then he picked it up again in his 60s, and he was still playing into his 90s.
Ronnie Shuker is the author, editor, writer, editor-at-large with the Hockey News. His book is called A Country in the Game, 30,000 Miles of Hockey Stories. You're listening to the Prince George Cougars CAT Scan podcast, and we've been going around to the country with your hockey stories, and now we are into Western Canada and the prairies, which you call big game country.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, when they drive to Trans-Canada, they complain about driving through the prairies. Personally, I love it. I love the open, the big sky and the open road of the prairies. It's just like one long break away from Winnipeg all the way to Edmonton or Calgary, depending on which route of the Trans-Canada you take. So I really enjoyed driving through the prairies and going to different hockey towns. That was one of my favorite parts of the trip.
Right. And what about some of the places that you went to on the prairies? What sort of stood out to you? What kind of interesting stories do you tell in the book regarding that?
One place that stands out is a place called Baker Community, which is a Hutterite colony just west of Winnipeg. I was invited there just to play hockey on their outdoor rink. And I was... As happens so many places across the country, hockey was a door onto a window of Canadian culture. You know, I just spoke about the Finnish community in Thunder Bay. I knew next to nothing about Hutterite culture and never been to a Hutterite colony. I read up on their history and the background and coming from the Anabaptist movement from the, 15th or 16th century. And they, you know, not only did they invite me to play hockey with them, they invited me to have dinner with them, to pray with them, to, you know, go tour their, you know, their facilities. They have a company called Better Air Manufacturing, which makes ventilation for agricultural farms. That's sort of their main employer. But they just sort of walk me through how they live. They have one bank account for the entire community. They have 12 vehicles that people just share. They have dinner together in this huge dinner hall every night. The kids have their own room. The adults have their own room. It's just a different way of living. And because I was invited to play hockey, I got to see how they live and their culture and understand this culture that I knew nothing about. So that was a real highlight, not only just to play hockey, but just to learn about this unique culture in our country. I went to Flin Flon, Manitoba, to see the legendary Bombers. I think people, even people who haven't been to Flin Flon, probably know about the Bombers in one way or another, whether it's through Bobby Clark or Reggie Leach or Mystery Alaska. There's a reference to the Bombers. I just I learned about the team, and I sort of found out that Flin Flon and the Bombers are sort of one and the same. So you really can't talk about the team, or you can't talk about the town without talking about the team. That's how intertwined the Bombers are with the town of Flin Flon. It basically mirrors and mimics the mining mentality of the town. You know, I also went to I caught Connor Bedard while he was playing junior with the Regina Pats. Everybody was talking. As soon as I got to Winnipeg, people were talking about Connor Bedard. And, I mean, of course, I knew who he was, and I knew he was going to go first overall. But I really wanted to see him play live. And I was glad I did, because I really got a sense of how far, you know, he was beyond his peers. Like, it was really interesting to see. He gave the puck away probably half a dozen times, but only because his teammates didn't know the puck was coming. He just saw the ice differently. It's really interesting to see players of his ilk who are just far and away past their peers. They just see the game, see the ice differently. And I could see that in real time, watching from the press box.
That was in Regina?
Regina Pats, yeah.
Yeah, that was you watched his home game for when he was with Regina then.
Yeah, which is an experience of itself. You know, Regina and Saskatoon are kind of in this tier of NHL light cities. They're not big enough to have an NHL team, but they're sort of too big to have that small town feel of hockey. So teams like the Pats and the Blades, you know, the Chicoutimi Sanguinines, if I'm pronouncing that properly, teams like that are sort of middle-sized teams, but have a junior team. It's kind of like their NHL, and that's sort of the feel I got for the Regina Pats, is that this was their NHL team. And I actually met a fellow, his name is Kevin Shaw. He's a Regina Pats super fan, and he's a team historian, and I got a sense from him of how important the Regina Pats are, the Pats are to the city of Regina.
Did you sense any rivalries there in Saskatchewan? Because, you know, Regina, Moose Jaw, WHL, those are big rivalries with Saskatoon. I don't know if you were in there long enough to get a sense of any real rivalries within that province.
Well, there's certainly a rivalry between Regina and Saskatoon. You know, it's just a two-hour shot up Highway, I think it's 11, that links the two towns. So there's certainly a huge rivalry between them. I also went to a senior hockey game in a league called the Highway Hockey League, which has a long history, 50-some-odd years, and there's this team called the Lumsden Monarchs. And they're the sort of the last team from the heydays of senior hockey in Saskatchewan, back when, you know, it was original six NHL, and these teams were sort of, you know, this is where many NHL teams plucked players from. This is when senior hockey was a place where you could actually eke out a bit of a living, making money, playing games. And the Lumsden Monarchs were still hanging on. Senior hockey there is, it's sort of dying, but the Lumsden Monarchs are still hanging on. They have a wonderful history. I got to watch a game, and it's really good hockey. I was surprised at how good the hockey was. I guess it's a whole bunch of former junior players, some of them minor pro, some of them have played overseas in pro leagues in across Europe, in university hockey in Canada, and it's just this really good hockey that you, I think I'd pay $10 to go watch, and there were maybe 100 people watching it, and yeah, it was just an awesome game to watch. High-level hockey in a small town in Saskatchewan.
Right. Okay, well, from the prairies, you went to the territories, Call of the North.
Yeah, so I went to Rankin Inlet, which we've talked about, and then this was an experience just driving the territories. I mean, just getting up there from Edmonton, you have to take the Mackenzie Highway. It took us 2 days to get into the territories, and we went to Yellowknife to a place called Houseboat Bay, which is a corner of Yellowknife Bay on the edge of town, where this is an eclectic community of houseboaters who live there year-round, and in winter, the community gets together, they shovel off a patch of the bay once it freezes, and they build this small rink, about a third of a regulation rink, just out of plywood and 2x4s, and, you know, people can just drive up, join a game, leave a game. There's an informal hockey league called the Houseboat Bay Hockey League, but it's basically just a rink that people can come play whenever they want, day or night, under the midnight sun or under the northern lights, some of the most picturesque landscape of the country. And I was joined by Stroh from the Beer League Hockey Hall of Fame for that part of the road trip. And we just went there and we just played hockey for a couple of days. It was probably the most picturesque place I played on the road trip, outdoors, on the bay. The weather was, we got lucky. It was about -5, clear sky, blue sky, no wind. Across the ice road was the Snow King Winter Festival going on, a huge ice castle, frozen ramparts, ice sculptures. Like, it was just hockey at its purest and picturesque. That really stands out from the territories.
How many outdoor games did you see over the course of the 8 months or participate in?
Only ones that I played in. I didn't see any outdoor games. I played in one in Grimsby, Ontario, that didn't make the book. I played at Hutterite Colony. I played in Houseboat Bay. I think that's it. It's hard to go through the Rolodex in my head quickly to see, did I play in this town? Those are the three that I can remember off the top of my head, and I'm sure there are others.
Well, if you're ever going on another hockey journey, I'll tell you one place you'd want to go, and that's Fort St. James, B.C. It's about a 2-hour drive from Prince George, because every year in the month of January, they have the Northern Classic, and that is the B.C. Elite Hockey League. They host Caribou Cougars of Prince George. They host a team, and they go, and they play outdoors, and the girls, Northern Capitals, they play outdoors. Fort St. James treats people incredibly, and it's quite an experience. So that might be something you may want to look at down the road if you're ever back in B.C., because outdoor hockey in Fort St. James, home of the Playfairs, that is something to experience in itself.
Oh, wow. I wish I had learned about that before I had done the road trip. I would have made that part of the book for sure. This is the thing. There are just so many people have said, did you go to this place? Did you see this? Did you see that? And I was like, oh, I didn't know about it. I wish I did. That sounds like hockey at its best. I am going to have to do that.
Yeah,
that
and especially since you were in Prince George, if you would have known. But these things, you sort of find out after. And that's why, you know, maybe there's going to be a second book that comes out or whatever. But I know, just hearing your experience, that if you go to Fort St. James in mid-January, outdoor hockey for the guys and the girls, and these are teenagers, elite hockey players, it will be an experience you will not forget. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about the territories. Now we're getting into BC, the last game.
Yeah, so I titled that chapter after the final story in the book, which happened in Kamloops. My father, he actually just passed away on this past January 22nd. He had advanced dementia. And he, you know, I think a lot of people now, they have hockey moms. When I grew up, I had a hockey dad. My mom took my sisters to figure skating. My dad took me to hockey. That's sort of the parental duties that they divided up. And I really wanted to pay tribute to my dad for not only bringing me to the game, but for all he did, you know, just, you know, waking up at 4:30 in the morning to take me at, you know, to early morning practice, middle of the week before he goes to work, schlepping me to tournaments on weekends, you know, his only days off, and he spent driving me to Coldwater, Ontario, or upstate New York for a tournament just so I can go have fun playing hockey. I took him to a Kamloops Blazers game, and his dementia was so advanced at that point, I knew, I was like, this is going to be the last game I'm ever going to see with my dad. And we went, and it was just one of those perfect nights where everything went right. My dad had a real penchant for wandering, which is one of the reasons why we had to put him in care. One night he left my mother's condo we shared with my mother in the middle of the night, no winter jacket, nothing, and the police brought him home. And so I was worried that he would actually just get up out of his seat and leave. So I had brought four blueberry muffins to keep him preoccupied because the man loved to eat. By the first period, they were all gone. And there was a couple behind me, Alex and Stephanie Bell. I will never forget. They saw that I needed help because I couldn't leave my father, you know, to go get food or go to the washroom. So they kept bringing me food, kept bringing me hot dogs. He ended up eating three hot dogs, a bag of popcorn, a huge thing of Coke. And we made it through the whole game without him wondering. The Blazers ran away with the game. People, you know, after the game, the usher stopped people from coming up the aisle to let my father out. People just instinctively knew that I needed help. One fellow helped me grab my dad's hand, walk him across the road so we get across safely. It was just one of those games that just went perfectly. And I'll remember that for the rest of my life. That was a tribute to my dad. And that's why I named that chapter The Last Game.
So how did you, where was your dad living? How did you arrange for all that then?
He was living at a facility called the Hamlets at Westside in Kamloops. Okay. And I just told the staff, I'm coming into town. Can you get him ready? I am going to take him to a Blazers game. I was really just hoping to get through the first period because my dad really liked to wander. And he had this thing where he would take his clothes off in inappropriate places. So I was deathly afraid that we would end up on YouTube. But he kept his clothes on. He stayed in his seat. We watched the game. And it was interesting because even though his dementia was so advanced, he could understand concepts like offside and penalty kill and power play. He would get distracted anywhere else. He would get really distracted. But for some reason, when he was watching hockey, whether on screen or live, he would just sit there and he would just sort of stare at the ice, follow the game. And every once in a while, he'd say something to me that made me realize, oh, geez, he understood that that was just an icing call. It was remarkable. You know, you hear stories about people who have advanced dementia getting at a piano, playing something they learned as a kid and playing it perfectly. And I guess this was sort of my dad's thing. Because he had been in the game so long, he understood these concepts, even though he had difficulty putting on his shoes. So it was just, it was probably my favorite story in the book. It was great to share that moment with my dad before he passed.
Did he have the same hockey passion that you have?
You know, that's the thing. He really didn't. He realized early that I just loved the game. And so he was never one of these deluded hockey dads that thought his kid is going to make the NHL. I think he always knew that, I didn't have the talent for it, but I loved playing. And so he just kept taking me year after year, whether it was in competitive hockey or house league hockey. He would take me to practices and games just so I could play the game, you know, learn whatever life lessons hockey has to teach, stay active as a kid, you know, make friends, all that stuff. But he himself, he was more of a baseball fan, ironically. You know, he kind of liked the Leafs, but he was more a Toronto Blue Jays fan. But just because his son wanted to play hockey, he was the best hockey dad I could ask for. He never yelled at me after a game, never told me what I did wrong. He just quietly took me to and from games, spending time on the road with him in the car, just talking about life and just bonding with my dad. It was wonderful.
So you eventually get to Prince George. How long were you in Prince George for? You watched the Cougars in Seattle. It was a playoff game, one in 2022 where the Thunderbirds won quite handily. But tell us about how you arrived in PG. And then once you tell us about that, I'm going to ask you about Ralph Pastorero. But let's set the scene for coming to Prince George.
Mm-hmm. So I came from Prince George from Stewart, BC. Stewart was my first stop in British Columbia. It's this small mining town right on the border with a town in Alaska called Hyder, Alaska. I never knew nothing about this place. It is this quirky, far, far right-wing libertarian town in Alaska, which has basically no amenities. It has a Canadian customs border guard, but no U.S. border guard. It has no police, no fire. All it gets is groceries and electricity, everything from Stewart, BC. I invite people to read about that in the book. It's a really quirky place. So I went from Stewart down the Stewart-Cassiar Cassiar Highway and then over to Prince George. And from Prince George, I would go to Prince Rupert to go to Haida Gwaii to talk about the Islanders. But yeah, so that was Prince George was the second stop on the trip. And I came from Stewart down to the Trans-Canada and over. I'd never been to Prince George before, so that was my first time.
Ronnie Shuker wrote the book, The Country and the Game, 30,000 Miles of Hockey Stories. Well, you talked to a very interesting bus driver with the Prince George Cougars at the time, very well known in the community, very well respected, Ralph Pastorero.
Yeah, I was glad. I was glad I was able to connect with Ralph. The Cougars are wonderful. They hooked me up with him. I was so excited to talk with somebody who had driven more in one hockey season than I had. Ralph put so many miles, kilometers on the road. I think he said he put 800,000 by the end of his career. It might have been more. But I was really taken by Prince George, just the fact that its closest opponent is Kamloops. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct.
I think that's, yeah, 4.5, 5 hour drive.
Closer to six in the winter, 5.5 if you're speeding, five, you know.
Yeah, so I was amazed by this. It's like, how does this team survive with its closest opponent so far away, right? I mean, like Regina and Saskatoon, they can shoot up the highway and they're there in 2 hours. And and the Cougars, you know, that's their closest opponent. I was dumbfounded by this. So I really wanted to find out what the most traveled team in Canada was. I'm not going to include NHL teams because traveling by air, that just does not count. If you're has to be on the road, and I couldn't pin it down, but I am fairly certain that it is Prince George. The Cape Breton Eagles say that they are the most traveled team in Canada, but from my math, it's the Prince George Cougars.
And Brandon's pretty close too. Brandon is in that neighborhood, but I think Prince George even has them beat.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least Brandon has the Winnipeg Ice, right?
No, Winnipeg's not there anymore. They moved.
Did they fold?
They moved. They moved to Wenatchee. So, yes. So, Brandon doesn't have Winnipeg anymore. Their closest now would be Regina.
Okay, so they're probably in the realm of Prince George now. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so, go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, so I was just taken with the fact that the Cougars had to do so much traveling. So, I wanted to speak to somebody who knew firsthand about this travel, and Ralph was the perfect guy to talk to. He seemed to be a man of few words, very humble, very gracious. Didn't seem to like any kind of spotlight on him, but you know, I was able to learn about the logistics of the travel, the hours and hours and hours, the miles, and I was stunned that he hadn't really had any real trouble outside a blown engine once. Can't remember where he was going. I think he was going to Kelowna. They talked about storms he had to go through making a trip across the border, I think to Portland. He got the team there 45 minutes before the game started. never hit any moose or anything like that. I was just regaled by the stories that he would tell. I think he drove for 20 years, most, I think 19 on one bus, and then the final year on a new bus. So I just sat there enraptured by Ralph's tales of his 2 decades on the road with the Cougars.
I had him on a podcast once. We talked about his journeys and everything like that. He would get wrapped up in the games. He wasn't just driving the bus. He was a big, big fan. And he could get on the referees' cases now and then. I mean, he was all in, and as popular when he was with the team driving the bus as anybody else with that club.
Yeah, well, when I went to interview him, he had his Cougars jacket on and his Cougars jerseys underneath, so I could tell he was a huge supporter of the team. But he did not tell me he would rile up the referees. He didn't share that story.
You have to talk to Ralph a little bit, really get to know a little bit, and have him open up, because as you say, he's quite quiet. He likes to sort of stay to himself, but he's got some really strong opinions. Incredibly likable in the community, and what he did for hockey. I mean, just volunteering, driving the bus as long as he did, as safe as he did for the Prince George Cougars, really, as you mentioned, is remarkable.
Yeah, and, you know, this is really a strong thrust of the book, is that I wanted to tell these stories of these people who are really the foundation of the game. You know, like, without people like Ralph, hockey doesn't exist. It doesn't, you know, you can't have the Cougars without a guy like Ralph driving them around. There are guys like that all across the country, men and women, you know, in the background, keeping the game going at some level or another, whether it's minor hockey, pro hockey, junior hockey. It's people like Ralph who are really the foundation of the game. And these are the stories I wanted to, you know, find and tell. And his was one of them.
Anything else about Prince George that you remember or think about or want to pass on before we go to the conclusion of the book?
You know, I just wish I had spent more. I got 2 nights there, and that was it. And unfortunately, the one game that I got to see, it was a blowout. It was 8-something. Yeah. Wasn't even close. It was 4-0 after the first period.
It ended up 8-2. I suffered through that one, yep.
Yeah, and I think the next game was very much the same. So unfortunately, that's the main memory I take away from Prince George, but I'm sure I will return again.
Well, yeah, for sure. Okay, so after BC, the road.
Yeah, so I just wanted to wrap up the book with I just wanted to put maybe a bow on the road trip. So I didn't want to tell people at the start of the book what I was doing. I wanted to save it to the end. I just wanted to show them the stories and at the end and say, you know what, this is what I think of hockey in Canada. And I was really, throughout the road trip, I was stuck by how important just the road figures in hockey, literally and metaphorically. Junior hockey is a perfect example. The players spend more time on the bus than they do on the ice, on the dressing room, in the weight room. It's the bus that they spend most of their time together. At any competitive level in Canada, because of the sheer size of the country, you're spending so much time on the road, whether it's minor hockey, junior hockey, minor pro, just driving to an away game, you're talking hours, especially in the case of junior hockey, just because the places are so far apart. And even metaphorically, there's the road to the Stanley Cup. You have places across the country like Portage in Maine and Winnipeg, or the Red Mile in Calgary, where fans will congregate to cheer on their team in the playoffs. There's the concept. There's an analytic in hockey called the Royal Road. It's a line that goes, an imaginary line that goes down the middle of the ice from net to net. That Steve Valiquette, a former NHLer, NHL goalie, created to sort of figure out how good goalies were, depending on how, it's a complicated concept, but it basically tells you how good a goalie is as opposed to just the straight stat of save percentage. There are all these things related to the road. It's like a rite of passage for anyone who plays hockey. And I was just struck by that. And I just sort of wanted to wrap up the book by an explanation of the road's place within hockey. You know, it's not, it's an important part at any level. NHL aside, you know, they're in five-star hotels and first-class flights. But if you're playing hockey at any other level, you're living a life on the road. It's like a rite of passage, even just road hockey. You know, so many people come to hockey through road hockey or street hockey in their neighborhood. It's just, I think it's an underappreciated fixture within the game in Canada.
Now, you are from Southern Ontario, and a lot of the road trips there are quite short, but in Prince George and area, it's not just the Cougars, but it is teams that are young. You know, they can be 8, 9, 10. They're traveling to Kelowna. They're traveling to the Lower Mainland. These are, you know, trips that are 8 to 10 hours. So, yes, it is at the junior hockey level, but it is also, there are old-timers teams that travel. They're all different ages that travel. It's just part of life. And after a while, for somebody that, you know, hasn't been through it, they probably think, wow, that's something. For somebody that's involved in it, that does all that travel, and not just hockey, but for other sports, when you are not that situated close to all these other centers, it's just a way of life. It's just, that's what we do.
Yeah, and I was struck by that. I mean, as you said, because I'm from the Greater Toronto Area, I still had to do road trips, but they were not the extent that they do in places like BC. Like my nephew, who's now 13, Holter, he's a goalie with the under 13 Kamloops Blazers, and he has five teams in his league. Prince George is one of them, and I was amazed that just the extent of the driving that his parents have to do to get him to games in Vernon, in Prince George, in Spokane. I can't remember the other teams in the league. There's Kelowna and Kamloops. I mean, like you said, there's just this incredible amount of driving at, you know, the under 13 level. So at any level of hockey, you're just spending so much time on the road. And it's just part of the game, you know, inevitably part of the game in Canada, just the sheer size of the country.
What stories did not make the book and why were they edited out?
Well, mainly because of space. My publisher gave me a page count I had to stick to.
Which is how many pages?
244.
Okay, so you had to stick to 244. So what sort of got edited out that you really didn't want to take out then or something like that?
Yeah, well, one that sticks out is in St. John's, Newfoundland. I came across a fellow at Signal Hill. Signal Hill is where the first transatlantic communication was made in 1901, I think. And he was a tour guide there, and he just found out that I was looking for hockey stories, and he said, I got a hockey story for you. And he told me about this high school hockey game, annual high school hockey game called, I think it was called the Jones Championship. And it took place in, I'm going to say, Cornerbrook. I can't remember because it was edited out of the book, but sort of the western part of Newfoundland. And it was a Protestant high school and a Catholic high school, and it was a rivalry that happened every year, sort of like the Army-Navy College football championship in the States. Mm-hmm. And it would divide the town, so there'd be people who were Protestant, people who were Catholic, on one side or the other, and it was just this event that enraptured the town. And one year, this fellow, his name is Matt House, he told me that his uncle, who was a kid at the time, after the game, got on the ice, stole the opposing team's goalie stick, and took it home, never returned it. And then when he got older, he passed it down to his nephew, Matt. And Matt had kept the stick, and he had had it for how many years, and then he decided he was going to try and track down the goalie who he took it from, who his uncle took it from. And he managed to track the person down in St. John's. but he hadn't given the stick back yet. He had become so attached to the stick, it had such sentimental value being given to him from his uncle, that he was wrestling whether to give the player back his stick. So it was just this short story. It wasn't a big story in the book, but I cut that, and that's one that stands out. I really wanted to keep that in just because I thought it was a real quirky story. But there are others. You know, I went to Saint-Justin in Quebec, which is the author Rock Carrier's hometown. He, of course, wrote The Hockey Sweater.
Right.
And I just wanted to see the places that he wrote about in the book. So there's the church. The rink is gone, but I went to the place where the rink was. You know, his former home. I was given a tour by a local there, and there's a street named after Rock Carrier. There's an ice cold barn, probably the coldest place I went to, arena I went to on the trip. I can't remember the name of it, but it's part of an old railway station, which has been converted into like a breakfast club. And there's the arena attached to it, and it's just one of these Quonset huts. And oh, boy, was it freezing. And the person who takes care of that facility, his uncle was Guy Lafleur. Oh. So he just regaled me with Guy Lafleur stories in my broken French as best as I could understand and speak with him. I got to talk with, you know, Guy Lafleur's nephew, and he was just telling me about Guy Lafleur, who had passed not too soon before. So that was one story I had to leave out of the book, and there are just others across the country. I can't remember them all, but there were about 20 or 25 I had to cut. You know, everyone took a bit of my hockey heart with it.
When you were doing this over the winter, what was the coldest temperature that you were experiencing, or with wind chill or something like that? Or was there a point where somewhere you had to say, I got to get indoors here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Minus 57 in Rankin and Lead.
Hold on a second. Minus 57?
Minus 5.7, yes.
Where?
In Rankin and Lead, Nunavut.
You were there. You were actually there, minus 57, and you're here to talk about it.
And I walked in it. So I flew into Rankin Inlet, and the taxis were all taken. I was too impatient to wait until one would open up. So I said, forget it. I'm just going to, you know, on the map, it was only about half a kilometer to my accommodation. So I said, I'm just going to walk it. How bad can it be? It was cold, let me tell you. And, you know, I like the cold, so... It was really just my face. I didn't bring a balaclava, which is what I needed. The rest of me was fine. I enjoy the cold. I was properly dressed. But because I didn't have a balaclava on, my face was stinging beyond belief just because it's just so cold. So that's what I remember most, is especially the point of my nose. I think I got a touch of frostbite. It was so cold. At one point when I was walking to the arena from my accommodation, I had to jump into a grocery store just to warm up because my face was physically hurting. So minus 57 in Rankin Inlet, I will never forget that. There was also minus 49 in Moose Factory, Ontario, which is the southern coast of James Bay. That was cold. But Gumpy was amazing. Started every time that I was in Moose Factory every morning, minus 40-something. Hit minus 49, but minus 57, that's next-level cold.
Yeah, you see, I don't mind walking in the cold. For me... it's not the cold so much. It's the winds. I don't know. Did you ever come into wind chills that were like, oh, this wind is just too much to take?
You know, I got lucky in both, I guess, you know, lucky as I could in Moose Factory and Rankin Inlet. It was minus 49 and minus 57, but the wind chill was very low. So it was just the basic cold that I had to walk through. And you're right, the wind is the worst. So I luckily did not experience any place where the wind, other than annoyance, was, you know, significantly cold.
Yeah, I know sometimes I've taken walks in minus 30, minus 35, and I'm the only one out there, and people think you're nuts. But, you know, if you do dress for it and you do have a balaclava, you know, it's not as cold as it appears as long as that wind is sort of not around too much.
Yeah, and as long as you keep moving, right?
Yeah, just keep going.
Just keep going, yeah. And I, you know, honestly, July and August, I hate. Those are the months I hate. I am not a summer person. I do not like the heat.
Well, and you get it there in Ontario.
Oh, yeah, we do. Oh, it gets hot. And I basically hibernate for those 2 months. because I just do not enjoy it at all. I love the winter, but that was a winter experience I'd never had before. So that was something I'll always remember.
You're obviously a hockey nut and beyond. Anything else that's even remotely close? No, not talking about family or things like that, but anything else that, you know, you could think about that would even come close to being the kind of passion you have for hockey? Like, is there a food you like as much? Is there something else that you do? Is there something that you play? Anything? Is there a, you know, an instrument? Is there something else that's even remotely in the neighborhood of what drives you for hockey?
Oh, that's a really good question. Nobody's asked me that before. You know, I'm going to say two things. One are my morning hikes. I am lucky enough to live on the Oak Ridges Moraine. People in BC will probably not know it, but it's this green belt north of Toronto. It's sort of this strip of greenery that sort of cuts through all the subdivisions. And I'm lucky enough to live right on a strip of it. And there's this path that goes through these ponds and the field, and nobody takes it. I don't know why. It's this beautiful area. I'm always the only one on these paths. I take it almost every day, especially in winter. I do not do it in July and August because it's just too hot. But that is something that I square away for every day. That's the way I start my day, and I just love it to no end. Outside of that, I'm going to say playing guitar. I'm not good at it by any stretch, but it's one of those things. And, you know, wrap up a work day, I finish my work, have my dinner, I sit down and I play my guitar. We don't have cable here, so if I watch TV, it's just YouTube. But I'm, you know, that's what I do. I spend my evenings play guitar until my wife comes home from work, and then we, you know, we'll watch a movie or something, or I'll read. But yeah, playing guitar is a thing for me. So maybe there's a music book in my future somehow. I actually talk about hockey rock in the book, which I thought was pretty fun. It was an interesting part of the book.
So there might be a part two?
I would love nothing more. But it's the book has to sell extremely good for me to do that, because it's a very big expense. It was actually ended up being twice as expensive as I had originally budgeted, because I was supposed to do it in 2020. My proposal got accepted, but COVID then hit. So I had to push the, you know, Delta killed the book in 2020, and then 2021 came around, and then there was Omicron. So I didn't get to do it until 2022. And by then, you know, supply chains had backed up. Then the war in Ukraine started, and gas prices went up. I mean, it was just all these cumulative things that ended up pushing the road trip to twice as much as it cost. So here's hoping that people like the book enough that they'll buy it, support my work, and I can recoup the cost. And I would love nothing better than to do a volume two.
Well, on part one of the podcast, I think we went 45 minutes. This, I'm pretty sure, is over an hour now. Anything that we haven't touched upon from the book or the experience or anything else that you would like to mention, or something else that maybe that I have not brought up?
You know, I could talk all day about the places I went to and the places that didn't make the book, but I think we've done a pretty thorough examination. I would just, if any of your listeners are intrigued by any aspect of our conversation, I invite them to pick up the book. I am sure there's 50 plus stories in there. There's going to be at least one story that resonates with them, whether it's Prince George or another part of the country. There's a story in there for everyone. And yeah, I would invite people, if they do pick up the book, you know, you can Google me, ronnieshuker.com, contact me, send me an email. I love hearing from readers what they think of the book, good or bad. Send me what you think. If you find a mistake, let me know about it so I can fix it for the next edition. I love getting feedback from readers.
Give your email then.
You can email me directly at ronnieshuker@gmail.com. Or you can go through my website. There's a form there you can fill out, and I'll get the email. But happy to email me directly at ronnieshuker@gmail.com.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed both episodes and getting to hear your stories and the adventure and Obviously, he's a big hockey fan, myself and so many that listen to the podcast. I found it quite fascinating, and I appreciate that.
Pleasure's all mine, Harley. Thank you for having me, and go Cougars, go.
Ronnie Shuker wrote the book, The Country and the Game, 30,000 Miles of Hockey Stories, published by Sutherland House Books in Toronto. This has been part two, and you have been listening to the Prince George Cougars CatScan podcast. Have a great one.